Good evening, it's Sunday, December 19th, 2021. Coming up on tonight's news, we take a look at the state of affairs for the nearly 80,000 Afghan evacuees who fled Afghanistan after the U.S. withdrawal and the Taliban takeover.
My kids, they were like badly affected by depression, trauma. They started fighting with each other. They were asking me why I brought them here. I had to take them back to your home and stuff.
And we take a look at a community in the Midwest that is preparing to welcome 75 of them.
And these individuals, the majority of them, the vast majority, are in some. They're coming here now in their time of need. And I think it's a perfect chance for us to just to demonstrate what it looks like to respond with compassion in these circumstances.
I'm Sharon Sabota, and this is the KPFA Weekend Evening News. It's been 4 months since the United States withdrew from Afghanistan. Since then, nearly 80,000 people have evacuated the country. Many of those evacuees have resettled in states across the country, and several dozen have reportedly been relocated to a base in Kosovo because of the U.S. screening process. And there are hundreds of others, like Najibullah Azad, his wife, and his four children, ranging in ages from 2 to 9, that are in a holding pattern at a military base in Southern Virginia. Earlier this year, I brought you a story of an evacuee named Quagga Ghani, who was stuck at Fort McCoy, Wisconsin, and waited for 2 months to get to her final destination in California. Azad's story is different in that after leaving Afghanistan in mid-August, he spent 2 weeks in Qatar, 54 days in Germany, and came to the military base in Virginia, where he learned that his first and second resettlement options were at capacity, and where he's now eagerly awaiting to get to his third resettlement choice of Wisconsin. I spoke with Azad about his work in Afghanistan that made it necessary for him to flee the country, and also about his experiences navigating life in military bases with his four children and his partner.
I was the senior political and legal advisor to ISAF from 2008 to 2009. Then I became the spokesman to President Ghani, the former president of the Republic of Afghanistan. I've been a policymaker at the U.S. Embassy, specifically working with the Defense Attaché Office. I'm a writer, I'm a poet.
And then you also have four children and a spouse, and they're all staying with you right now at the base.
I got four children, a son of 9, and then a daughter of 7, and then a son of 5, and then the youngest one is 2 years old, and my spouse, my wife, Sarma. We're all here on the base. I was supposed to select Northern Virginia because it's very close to Washington, D.C., where I was already offered some good jobs that I used to work in the past with those organizations, including Voice of America and some other media outlets and an Institute of Foreign Affairs to teach there. But unfortunately, those states were full. And then I selected Maryland, which is again closer to D.C. The same thing with Maryland, there was no space. So then I selected Wisconsin for many reasons. My cousin lives there, one thing, and then, well, according to the research I made, the school rating is 10, and then the lowest crime rates in Wisconsin, and the so I selected Wisconsin, an agency which I found myself, not the IOM. I talked to them, and then they proceeded the case, and then they gave it the capacity to the national agency, who assured my case by November 23. After your case is assured by the agency, you have to be departed in a day or two. So it's been 20 days. And when I knocked the IRC or IOM door, the only thing I've been hearing is just to wait. We are working on your case, and it's going to happen in a day or two. And this a day or two has been 20 days now. So that's the story that we've been sent here on the base.
Okay, and let's remind our listeners, this is 20 days on the heels of 60 other days. Another evacuee that I spoke with told me that Germany was horrific, the conditions that she had to live in. She said she barely survived there for 2 days, so I'm curious, how was your experience in Germany?
Well, it was terrible. You didn't have any razor to do your shaving and stuff. You didn't have any trimmer to trim your beard. You didn't have any nail clippers, you know. Not only people like me, even the children, you know. They grew your nails, and there was no nail clipper, and there was no scissor. You know, the only thing you were getting was a boiled chicken leg 24/7, like three times a new year mule, and that went on for 1.5 months. And then when we were moved to another place, which is called Rob, and then after 10 days, the same thing was there. Rob was the place we were living was LSA 5 with three tents, and every tent there were about 200 to 300 people in a tent. So there were three tents, so the roughly about 600 people were living there in about 2,000 square yards, a fenced place. And then you're not allowed to do anything. I mean, and then the only thing you were getting was that meal, the same meal for 1.5 months, exactly the same meal. So it was terrible. The clinic we had there, there were like two paramedics type people sitting there, or nurses. They were not, no physician there. And of course, people living there, the food, and then the trauma they left behind, you know, the anxiety they had, the depression, they left their country, they left their beloved ones. They needed medical facilities, they needed medical services, which was not available. So I can say like it was worse than a prison.
How did your children feel when they were there?
The elder one, who is 9, was 27 kg when we arrived Germany, and then when we left, he was 22. He lost 5 kg weight. The rest of them, like 2 to 3, 4 kg, they were not eating, because the same boiled chicken leg for 45 days, adults, they can manage it, you know, they can compromise, but the children, they don't listen and they don't understand the situation. So they started refusing eating and they got sick. My kids, they were like badly affected by depression, trauma. They started fighting with each other. They started even fighting with me. They were asking me why I brought them here. I had to take them back to their home and stuff. You know, there was no food. There was no books, no readings, no entertainment thing, anything for children that wasn't available. So they got badly sick, and then they got like abdominal pain, got fever, coughing, not eating. So yeah, it was terrible.
So when your children said, "Dad, this is terrible, we are miserable, why did you make us leave Afghanistan, why can't we go home?" What did you say to them?
The 9-year-old son and the daughter, they knew what I was doing. I was a spokesman, I was like kind of politician, and I was a target. And then they did understand the entire thing very soon. Their mother told them that if we did not leave Afghanistan, you would lose your father, and then you would be living in a worse situation. We're gonna pass these days very soon. It won't take longer. Yeah, it was hard, especially for the 5-year-old son and for the 2-year-old kid. He did not understand. He was unable to talk at all. But yeah, he kept crying all the time. You know, he was like badly stressed and depressed. But the other two, we kept giving them like counseling. It worked somehow. But yeah. During the night, during they were sleeping and stuff, and they started crying, screaming in their sleep. And yeah, of course, we had to give them a hug and then wake them up and talk to them. And the other thing, the worst thing was they're like, you were not allowed to turn your lights off, the bulbs, you know. They had to be there all the time. They have to be on all the time, and which would like the what they call it, the spotlights.
Oh, fluorescent lights were on while you were trying to sleep?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And then the soldiers, they could enter to your tent anytime and start, you know, talking the way the soldiers talk and stuff, you know. So everybody wakes up and then they walk around, you know, making jokes with themselves.
Azad had served as a spokesman for political leaders, including the late president of Afghanistan, Ashraf Ghani.
The last president, Ashraf Ghani, people used to think that he was a brilliant guy. He was not a brilliant guy. Well, he lived in the United States or in the West for decades. He did not know the Afghan norms very well. He did not even know how to talk to the Afghan tribal elders. And in a country like Afghanistan, a war-torn country, when you practice politics, there are many languages, there are many religions, there are many norms, cultures, tradition. Even like in 10 kilometers, you would see a different culture, or at least a different norm and tradition. And being a leader of that kind of country, you have to be familiar with every single thing. You have to know that how to talk to a Badakhshi, how to talk to a Pakhtiawal, how to talk to a Kandahari, and how to talk to person living in Kabul, you know, with different tune, with different accent, with different body language. He did not know that anything. The way he tried to practice was typical a Western politics there, you know, like a three-piece suit and then kind of dictatorship there. So he was not the Afghan's choice, but unfortunately, at the end of the day, we didn't have any other choice. And then he was well-trained by the U.S. I mean, he left there, and then before he became the president, he was brought to be the financial minister. I believe the plan was that he would get familiar with financial things, and then he was brought to be the chancellor of Kabul University to get in touch with the academicians, and then later he was nominated for the UN General Secretary General position, and then later he was given the position for the transition in Chita before 2014, the transition from the international forces to Afghan forces. So he would get in touch and he would get to know how the military things work, and then he brought the palace to be the president. Yet he failed. He totally failed. And the blame will not go only to United States or international forces. There were many things. I mean, 70% things would go back to the Afghan leadership, actually. Unfortunately, we Afghans, including myself, we have been blaming others all the time, you know, for 40 years that, well, United States did this, USSR did this, Pakistan is doing this. Well, what we are doing, what our responsibility was, what our reactions or actions were, what actions we did take, absolutely nothing.
I asked Azad for his take on why Ashraf Ghani fled the country, on the U.S.'s approach to leaving the country, and his views on the state of affairs in Afghanistan today.
Taliban entered about 6 or 7 p.m. On August 15th, but what happened was about 12 p.m. that day, a news was leaked on social media that Taliban had entered Kabul. So every checkpoint or checkpoint that was controlled by police and army, they left their trucks, they left their even the train to the train dogs. They left their scanning machines, screening machines on, and then everybody, you know, it was like a panic was created. Doctors left the hospitals, shopkeepers left their stores, teachers left the school, students left the school, people in private sectors, they left their offices. Everyone kept running towards their home. Nobody had a clue that overnight everything would be changed. Everyone that day were running towards the airport. It took me 3 hours on the vehicle, and then I left my vehicle and I started walking towards my home, because the panic which was created was, I believe, created purposely. Everyone had left the offices, all the government institutions were left, and then it was an opportunity for those to flee, including President Ghani. So that was a day that could never be forgotten in the history, of course, on our minds.
I mean, some people feel like the former president really just abandoned the people of Afghanistan by leaving the country. What do you feel?
Well, the people of Afghanistan, unfortunately, in the last 20 years, who ruled over Afghanistan? Those who were somehow favored or supported by the United States. And the United States had the power to make sure that the Afghan politicians, who were not politicians actually, unfortunately, they were like warlords, and they were brought into power. They were given millions, not millions, billions of dollars contracts, and that money was not the U.S. government's money. It was the U.S. people money, the American people, the taxpayers' money. You know, I believe that the decision shouldn't have been given to or left to Afghans, because it was not an Afghan matter. The Afghan war in Afghanistan was not an Afghan matter. It was an international matter. It was the war against terrorism. It was not a civil war. It was not an Afghan war. It was war against Al-Qaeda, war against ISIS, war against, of course, even Taliban. If the subject was not an Afghan matter, it was not an Afghan war, how would you leave things to Afghans only? And to those Afghans who do not have the capacity, who do not have the guts, who do not have the talent, or who do not have the intention, you know, to protect the humanity, to protect Afghans in the international community, all they were doing for their pockets. So it was, I believe it was a wrong decision leaving things to Afghans.
Well, I mean, also, it just sounds like the United States just kind of wiped their hands. They're like, okay, well, it's for you now, but now there's no political infrastructure, right? Because even even the president of the country is gone. So, like, is there something I'm missing? Because it just looks like there is no thought put into it.
We can say it now, after everything happened, that there was no political structure in Afghanistan. It was like kind of project, a temporary project. Because if there were a political structure, if there were a political culture, then, you know, it won't burnish or demolish in a day. I would even say security and defense forces we had, they were not security and defense forces at all. They fought as long as they had the U.S. Air support, and the day they left, so 350,000 security and defense forces just left everything and they went home. So at the end of the day, the 2 decades investment in Afghanistan made by the U.S. and by the international community, including NATO and European Union, they invested on a temporary project. You know, we cannot call it a political structure.
Azad says that when he and his family finally do make their way to Wisconsin, which at this point is likely to be postponed until early next year, he has many things on his agenda.
Well, the first thing I would like to do is in Wisconsin, or I would try to do that in the United States, is that we won't say like one-fourth, you know, like the picture of the Afghanistan that is given to the world was the women in blue burqa, or what you call it, chadri or not hijab, is not the real woman, you know. My wife, she is a fashion designer. She is a graphic designer. She had the biggest fashion brand in Afghanistan. So we would start from that, you know, to portray the real picture, the colorful picture of Afghan civilization, one thing. And then, of course, I would try to get somehow involved in things that will make sure the American policy for Afghanistan should work the work it had to be. I can even see the translators in here. They are like American citizens. They've got like American green cards. They are like translators on the base. And unfortunately, they don't even speak fair English, or they don't even speak Pashtun Dari. So these are things that really matters between the relationships between the countries and states. So I will try to keep working on columns, articles, and writing books on strategies and policies or foreign policy, the U.S. policy for Afghanistan, one thing. And then by profession, I'm a lawyer. I will try to practice law in Wisconsin. Well, after pass the state law test there. I'm graduated from an American school, so I don't have an issue with the degree. It's an American degree as well. But after passing
Wisconsin bar, test, yeah, okay,
yeah, and then I will keep writing things on the future, not the past. Everyone knows the past, you know, and it will be highlighted somehow. And meanwhile, we'll try to make sure that the American taxpayers' money is spent in the right way or on the right path.
You're listening to the Weekend Evening News on KPFA 94.1 FM in Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 FM in Fresno, K248BR 97.5 FM in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. I'm Sharon Sabota. Adam Van Noord is the director of the Multicultural Community Center, a branch office of the Ethiopian Community Development Council in Wausau, Wisconsin. Van Noord is helping to prepare the community to welcome 75 Afghan evacuees.
In terms of preparation, we've been having a lot of dialogue, making sure people in the community who provide things like, you know, public benefit enrollment, education, healthcare services, literacy, transportation, education for job skills, all of these people who are already doing great things to serve our community members, understand the population that we're working with and the uniquenesses of providing services for them. So that's been happening for the last couple of months. And besides that, we anticipate certain challenges. One being housing, and then a second being interpretation, due to the fact that Afghans don't exist in Wausau, Wisconsin. We don't have people to draw from for in-person interpretation. So for housing, we've been looking at a number of models that other, you know, communities have been using around the nation. One is, you know, looking at transitional housing, knowing that when we reach our peak volume of individuals arriving, it's going to become increasingly difficult to find affordable long-term apartments for them to move right into. The inventory just isn't going to be there. So transitional housing includes things like extended stay hotels, you know, working with Airbnb and their generous offer to, you know, basically subsidize or offer reduced rates for refugees for short term. We're looking at large group housing facilities where we could comfortably house up to 15 or 20 people with common living spaces, common dining areas. Again, it would be short term, but give us a little bit more time to secure apartments in the event that many people arrive at once. The last thing we're doing as far as housing procurement is getting some funding together to actually start renting homes now that are available, holding them essentially, and having the chance to furnish them, get them completely, you know, move-in ready, and maintaining an inventory of 5 or 6 places at any given time to reduce that bottleneck as well. As far as interpretation goes, lastly, we have an online service provider that is able to provide on-demand Dari and Pashto, which is the two primary languages that we expect these groups to come with. And we also have been in touch with some Afghans who are citizens who've been residing in the U.S. and are willing to provide web-based interpretation via Zoom or another virtual platform.
I asked Van Noor to talk about why the Afghan evacuees are called parolees and not refugees.
If you're like me and a lot of people, parolee has a strong connotation of the criminal justice system. So that's unfortunate, because even though that is the official term that the, you know, from an immigration standpoint, that is their status, Afghan parolee. It has nothing to do with their, you know, with the quality of their character. So what that's referring to is the sense that, you know, they were evacuated in a time of urgency, in a period of crisis. And so the vetting that normally takes, you know, months and years and occurs overseas through various partner agencies ended up happening here in the U.S. At the bases. And so Afghans who are coming under the current legislation are given the Afghan parolee status, meaning that they've been fully vetted. You know, there's 8 or 9 agencies, U.S. federal agencies, that were all involved in ensuring that these individuals check out, that they're safe. And during their time in the U.S., they have, you know, upon arrival, they have 2 years to change their adjustment of status from Afghan parolee to asylum seeker. And unless there's new legislation introduced in the months and years to come, that is the end game. There is no path to citizenship currently available to these individuals. However, once they have their asylee status, you know, they'll have the ability to live, you know, legally in this country, they'll be able to work, you know, and of course the children that are born will be, you know, full U.S. citizens, just like any other group or individual born in the U.S. But yeah, that's essentially a specific immigration status for this group that was designated.
At the end of the day, Van Noord urges people in communities across the United States to set aside differences and really focus on the opportunity to support fellow human beings in a time of need.
As much as there may be cultural differences and different faith backgrounds and you know, different political, you know, orientations, whatever those differences might be, they really pale in comparison to the need that these people are coming with to be viewed as you know, human. And they want the same things that we want. So I'm encouraging people to really see this as an opportunity to step in at a really critical time in history. You know, our forces, our government was involved in Afghanistan for 20 years officially. And these individuals, the majority of them, the vast majority, are in some way connected to the supports that our military and our government received on the ground in Afghanistan. So they're coming here now in their time of need. And I think it's a perfect chance for us to just express our gratitude, but also just to demonstrate what it looks like to respond, you know, with compassion in these circumstances.
Sarah Brock is the manager of a restaurant called Vino Latte in Wausau, Wisconsin, and a full-time graduate student. Brock is one of many people who got involved with the New Beginnings program in Wausau to help welcome the Afghan newcomers. She told us why.
One of the things that we've always done in my family is try to give back where we can. So I immediately called my mom and we went to Target. Because that's where you go in Wausau, you know, is Target, to load up on things. So that was my first experience, is we just, you know, sheets and towels and cleaning products and toothbrushes and toothpaste and anything we could think of that a new family coming into town would need. And we loaded up a cart and we took everything. And that was great. And then I got a notification on my Facebook page because I was following them that they were doing a meeting for volunteers. And so I talked to my husband about it. And you're probably familiar with the phrase that if you want something done, you ask a busy woman. And so we went and we listened and we enjoyed the speakers and learned about some of the things they were doing. And one of the things that they had was a giving tree project. And they just basically had envelopes of tags, and they were encouraging people, you know, put a tree up at work, put a tree up in your lobby, whatever else. And I thought, you know, that's not really something I can do at the restaurant. I don't own the business. I said, but, you know, let me get creative. What I do have is a lot of wine. Mm-hmm. I'm a wine drinker. My store is a wine boutique. So I thought, you know, I can do something online where I create a wine tree and put the tags on the bottles and post something out on Facebook and say, if you fulfill a tag, you get a bottle of wine. And shockingly enough, that works.
Brock offers non-alcoholic options like lunch or lattes to those who do not consume alcohol. And the weather. In the San Francisco Bay Area, partly cloudy tonight with lows in the upper 30s, partly sunny tomorrow with highs in the upper 40s. In the Fresno area, partly cloudy tonight with lows in the 30s, partly sunny tomorrow with highs in the low 50s. That's it for this evening's news. As always, thank you to you, our listeners, for tuning in. I'm Sharon Sabota. It's been a pleasure to be with you this evening. Good evening.